Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Just days before the state Senate takes up a massive criminal justice reform bill, several Massachusetts prosecutors are rallying against parts of the measure. 9 of the state's 11 district attorneys have signed a 6-page letter saying that the bill undermines the cause and pursuit of fair and equal justice for all. The letter, addressed to Senate President Stan Rosenberg and Senate Judiciary Committee Chair William Brownsberger, mentions some of the provisions in the bill that the DAs take issue with, including eliminating mandatory minimum sentences for certain drug crimes. The two DAs who did not sign the letter are Northwestern District Attorney David Sullivan and Middlesex County DA Marion Ryan, who happens to be president of the Massachusetts District Attorneys Association. Well, joining us is one of the prosecutors who did sign the letter, Suffolk County DA Dan Conley. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Deborah. Happy to be here.
Thanks for being with us. Also, we're joined by one of the addressees of the letter and sponsor of the criminal justice reform bill, State Senator William Brownsberger. He's chair of the Senate Joint Committee on the Judiciary. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Senator.
Delighted to be with you and delighted to be here with my friend Dan Conley.
And Dan, I just want to make sure that if you could tell folks, what are the prosecutors' main concerns about this legislation that's to be debated in the Senate Thursday?
Well, first of all, I should have said the same thing. I'm happy to be here with Will. He's been leading this effort in the Senate, and I have to say I have the greatest respect for him as a person and as a legislator. He's very smart, he's very thoughtful, and he's met with me at least a couple of times to talk about some of the ideas that ended up in this bill. I think one of the big concerns that the DAs have is that, first of all, it's a massive, you know, sprawling, complex piece of legislation. And, you know, I've been an attorney since 1983, and it took me a couple of good weeks to read it over and get even the understanding that I have of it now, and I think my colleagues, you know, feel the same way. You know, some of the ideas have been the subject of legislative committee hearings and so forth, but a number of the pieces of the bill presently before the Senate have not. It seems, frankly, to have been co-opted a bit or hijacked by some special interest and some really, ideas that we think are really quite dangerous.
Well, which one specifically? So are you saying it's too complicated to take up this many things in one piece of legislation?
That would probably, my advice would be, you know, that certainly I think most of the members of the Senate are not lawyers, to the best of my knowledge. I'm fairly quite sure if I had, you know, had to spend a good couple of weeks delving into this just to get the understanding level that I have right now, I'm sure they find themselves in the same predicament. But let me give you some of the things that should come as no surprise to Will.
I just wonder the examples of being co-opted or hijacked by special interests.
Oh, sure. I mean, creating, decriminalizing sexual behavior between pre-adolescents, for example, that's been co-opted by somebody. I don't know who. I don't think most citizens of the Commonwealth think that sexual relations between, say, a 14-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl are ever appropriate. I mean, that's
but hold on a second.
Two families that are in crisis.
Okay, Senator Brownsberger, I think, wants to address it and say, you know, why that's part of the legislation, that so-called Romeo and Juliet provision that would, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Senator, that would decriminalize consensual sex among some adolescents. Is that right?
People that are close in age. Basically, nobody's saying that's a good thing. I think it's a bad thing for kids to have underage sex, but that's up to the parents, the schools, the churches, the psychiatric social workers. It's not something that we really want to get jail involved with.
No one goes to jail. No 14-year-old boy is going to jail for having sexual relations with a 12-year-old girl. However, parents, police, teachers, community members, they turn to the district attorneys and, you know, there is absolutely no credible evidence that there's any issues around this. This is, as they say, the proverbial solution in search of a problem. And it's dangerous, really. I frankly can't believe that there's any honest broker out there who thinks that decriminalizing sexual relations between, say, an 18-year-old college freshman and a 15-year-old high school sophomore is good public policy.
Well, I think that's heard. Yeah, I think that's one version here, and I think we can get down and it's very controversial, of course, and I think we could spend the whole hour debating this, but
sure.
But let's talk about some of the other parts of the bill, because I think that's probably a very small part of the bill. Let's talk about some of the bigger issues, sort of mandatory minimum sentencing, which I think a lot of folks have talked about.
I mean, again, I said that this should come as no surprise to Will or no surprise, and I was very clear with him during my, you know, very respectful meetings, and I think most of the district attorneys have been as well, is that with, you know, none of us, including, I don't believe, the two DAs that did not sign on, believe that we should have mandatory minimum sentencing for low-level, nonviolent drug users. And the good news is we don't. Our laws are aimed at traffickers, people who are moving significant amounts of drugs, and we believe that these have been very effective over the last 25 years in helping prosecutors and police and communities drive down violent crime. I mean, look, I was an assistant DA in 1984, and by the late 1980s, I was assigned to the Homicide Response Unit, and I was out every hour of the day and night during my shifts when I was assigned in 1990 and 91 responding to horrific acts of violence that largely revolved around trafficking and the distribution of drugs. And, you know, Will's predecessors established baseline under which, you know, certain individuals who violated those laws would be held accountable in a way that required the judges to sentence a defendant to a minimum period of incarceration. And it worked. I mean, here we have, in that era, upwards of 150 people who were murdered in our city of Boston. And today, I believe we're in the low 40s. That's 40 plus too many. But it's an incredibly safer city today, 25 years later, than it was then.
Because of mandatory sentences.
In part. That's one part of the toolkit of police and prosecutors.
Okay, I'd like to give Senator Brownsberger just a sure. chance here to respond to some of your concerns and to say, you know, overall, what you're thinking about this letter, Senator.
Well, first of all, I just appreciate that DA has given it a close look, and there's a lot of knobs we can turn in this bill, and we'll keep working with them on all of them. But to the question of mandatory minimums, I agree with Dan on just about everything he said. There's a couple of distinctions I'd like to draw, though. But first, to agree, we all agree that there are no mandatories for nonviolent drug users. I also respect the work that law enforcement has done over the past many years to address the problem of violence, and we recognize that there is a relationship between that and drugs. And we all, in fact, favor a strong penalties on the books, mandatory minimum penalties, are willing to work with those mandatory minimum penalties for drug trafficking. And there's a statute, Chapter 32E, is the drug, Section 32E of Chapter 94C is the drug trafficking section. And we are not touching the heroin mandatory minimum trafficking penalties. In fact, we are strengthening them to include fentanyl and carfentanyl and all the other new, very poisonous, very dangerous drugs that are coming into circulation. We are lightening up a little bit on the cocaine mandatory minimums trafficking. But where we're putting our energy, and this is the important distinction, I want to distinguish between your traffickers and your low-level drug dealers. Not your low-level drug, not your users, but your low-level drug dealers, some of whom are also users, all of whom are kids that shouldn't be in, you know, that have gotten themselves into a bad business, but we want to turn them out of that business if we can. Jobs, if that's what they need, drug treatment, if that's what they need, rather than necessarily locking them up. So that's why we want to make that category of offense, what I would call the retail offense, the low-level drug dealer, as opposed to the wholesaler or the trafficker, not subject to mandatory minimum penalties, but something that the DA can work with the judge and sell them on sentencing the person to a lengthy sentence if that's what required, or perhaps to give more consideration to treatment if that's needed, or jobs or probation or whatever would be best.
So D.A. Conley, do you see that distinction there? You're saying we're not talking about major traffickers here. We're talking about low-level dealers who may be users, and certainly in the midst of an opioid crisis, judges are probably seeing a lot of this, and maybe there should be more judicial discretion in these cases.
Oh, I would say that all 11 district attorneys are very good and quite capable at distinguishing between low-level drug dealers who are dealing to support their own habits and those people that are actually trafficking and plying poison into neighborhoods and essentially wreaking havoc in those communities. Prosecutors, there have been prosecutors in the United States have been invested with discretion, and I would submit to you that the 11 prosecutors in Massachusetts, the district attorneys, exercised their discretion quite wisely. Every one of us, for example, has robust diversion programs. We have drug courts. We know and can pretty readily tell who needs to be incarcerated and who doesn't. You know, we hear a lot about being smart on crime. I would submit to you that the 11 DAs in Massachusetts have been and continue to be very smart on crime. Massachusetts remains only one of five states that has seen a decline in incarceration.
However, the rate, though, of incarceration since 1980 has gone up dramatically, as Senator Brownsberger has pointed out. And I just want to get to
that
because
again.
We only
what was that, Deborah? I'm not
that the rate of incarceration since 1980 in Massachusetts has increased dramatically, as it has in most states. We may have, I believe, a lower rate when compared with other states.
And about 49th in the country.
Right, second lowest according to the Council on State Governments. Yes, that's relatively speaking, in an era of mass incarceration. However, incarceration has increased dramatically.
Massachusetts was never a participant in the problem of mass incarceration. That was a problem that existed in Texas and in Alabama and Arkansas. And what's problematic is that a number of legislators, and I'm not putting Will in this category, conflate problems that occur in other parts of the country, including the federal government, and overlay those issues onto Massachusetts. And I've tried to persuade many of them, perhaps unsuccessfully, that Massachusetts is a criminal justice leader. Can we do better? Yes, we can. All you have to do is look at our great football team, and they always say after a victory is we can always get better at this, and I agree with that philosophy. So we can agree on things like the elimination of all the onerous collateral consequences, which, by the way, none of the district attorneys ever endorsed or supported. These were ideas largely put onto the books by legislators over the years. Things like a bail. I'm very open to looking at the question of whether bail, as we know it today, should be reformed. There are too many people being held on $100 or $200 or $500 bail. I'm open to that. The Globe headline was that DAs harshly criticized the Senate. I would actually disagree with that. What we have been trying to do, look, these are hard conversations. But the DAs have wanted to act very constructively. But this requires candid conversations. And we remain very concerned with a number of discrete parts of this Senate bill that if they become law, this will be a big step backwards for our Commonwealth.
I want to just make sure we get Senator Brownsberger in here. Senator Brownsberger, in terms of some of the things that District Attorney Conley has said, is Massachusetts already a leader and maybe doesn't need this level of reform? What do you say to that?
Well, I think I'd be one that here's how I look at it. Look, we have had. Within Massachusetts, comparing ourselves to ourselves, a huge increase in incarceration. Now, I'm not saying that's because we made a mistake. There's been a rise in crime. If you compare where we were in, let's say, 1960 to where we are now in terms of crime rates, we're higher now than we were. And so to have a higher incarceration rate maybe isn't a surprise, maybe isn't wrong. But here's where we are. We've gotten to a place where we have very high incarceration rates concentrated in neighborhoods of poverty and color. And that is a problem in itself. You know, moms and dads not around, kids without role models, a cycle of people just keep turning around into the system. And that's what we've got to be concerned about. However we compare to other states, and Dan's absolutely right, we have a relatively low incarceration rate compared to other United States. By international standards, we're very high. By comparison to ourselves, very high. And in neighborhoods of poverty and color, very, very, very high in absolute terms. Yeah. And so that's what we have to be concerned about. That's why this is a bill about lifting people up instead of locking people up and cutting the chains that make it hard for people to get back up on their feet when they've been in trouble. And that's those collateral consequences where D.A. Conley and I are 100% on the same page.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about this some more as the Senate takes this up on Thursday. Senator William Brownsberger, a sponsor of the Criminal Justice Reform Bill. He's also co-chair of the Joint Committee on the Judiciary. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Suffolk County District Attorney Dan Connolly, he's one of the signers of the letters to Senate leaders regarding concerns about the Criminal Justice Reform Bill. Thank you very much, District Attorney Connolly.
Thank you, Deborah. Happy to be with you. Look forward to continuing the conversation with Will and his colleagues.
Okay. Thank you.